Metal barrels, a space of perhaps an inch. She swam to it and looked through. Across a distance of 30 feet, she saw Manx standing on the end of the dock and the gas mask man behind him. Manx's face was painted with blood, as if he had gone bobbing for apples in a bucket full of the stuff.
My, oh my, you cut me very well, Victoria McQueen. You have made a hash out of my face, and my companion here has managed to shoot off my ear with friends like these. Well, I am blood all over. I will be the last boy picked at the dance from here on out. You see if I am not.
He laughed, then continued.
It is true what they say. Life really does move in very small circles. Here we are again. You are as hard to keep a hold of as a fish. The lake is a fine place for you.
He paused once more. When he began to speak again, there was almost a note of humor in his voice.
Maybe it is just as well. You did not kill me. You only took me away from my children. Fair is fair. I can drive off and leave you as you are. But understand that your son is with me now, and you will never have him back. Although I expect he will call sometimes from Christmas Land. He will be happy there. I will never hurt him. However you feel now, when you hear his voice again, you will see how it is. You will see it is better that he is with me than with you.
The dock creaked on the water. The engine of the Rolls-Royce idled. She struggled out of the soggy, heavy weight of Lou's motorcycle jacket. She thought it would sink straight away, but it floated, looking like a black, toxic mess.
"Of course, maybe you will be inclined to come and find us," Manx said. His voice was sly. "As you found me before. I have had years and years to think on the bridge in the woods. Your impossible bridge. I know all about bridges like that one. I know all about roads that can only be found with the mind. One of them is how I find my way to Christmas Land. There is the night road, and the train tracks to Orphanhenge, and the doors to Midworld, and the old trail to the treehouse of the mind. And then there is Victoria's wonderful covered bridge. Do you still know how to get there? Come find me if you can, Vic. I will be waiting for you at the House of Sleep. I will be making a stop there before I arrive in Christmas Land. Come find me, and we will talk some more.
He turned and began to clump back up the dock. The gas mask man heaved a great unhappy sigh and lifted the .38, and the gun burped flame. One of the pine boards above her head snapped and threw splinters. A second bullet zipped across the water to her right, stitching a line in the surface of the lake. Vic flung herself backward, splashing away from the narrow crack through which she had been spying. A third bullet dinged off the rusted stainless steel ladder. The last made a soft, unremarkable plop right in front of the float. She paddled, treading water. Car doors slammed. She heard the tires crunching as the car backed down across the yard, heard them thud over fallen fence rails. Vic thought it might be a trick, one of them in the car. The other one, the gas mask man, remaining behind, out of sight with the pistol. She shut her eyes. She listened intently. When she opened her eyes, she was staring at a great hairy spider, suspended in what was left of her web. Most of it hung in gray shreds. Something, a bullet, all the commotion, had torn it apart. Like Vic, it had nothing left of the world it had spun for itself. Search Engine, July 6 to 7. The Lake. As soon as Wayne found himself alone in the back seat of the Wraith, he did the only sensible thing. He tried to get the fuck out. His mother had flown down the hill. It seemed more like flying than running. And the gas mask man lurched after her in a kind of drunken, straggling lope. Then even Manx himself started toward the lake, hand clutched to the side of his head. The sight of Manx making his way down the hill held Wayne for an instant. The day had turned to watery blue murk, the world become liquid. Lake-colored fog hung thickly in the trees. The fog-colored lake waited down the hill. From the back of the car, Wayne could only barely see the float out on the water. Against this background of drifting vapor, Manx was an apparition from a circus, the human skeleton crossed with a stilt walker, an impossibly tall and gaunt and ravaged figure in an archaic tailcoat. His misshapen bald head and beaky nose brought to mind vultures. The mist played tricks with his shadow, so it seemed he was walking downhill through a series of dark, Manx-shaped doorways, each bigger than the last. It was the hardest thing in the world to look away from him. Gingerbread smoke, Wayne thought. He had breathed some of the stuff the gas mask man had sprayed at him, and it was making him slow. He scrubbed his face with both hands, trying to shake himself to full wakefulness, and then he began to move. He had already tried to open the doors in the rear compartment, but the locks wouldn't unlock no matter how hard he pulled at them, and the windows wouldn't crank down. The front seat, though, that was a different story. Not only was the driver's side door visibly unlocked, the window was lowered about halfway, far enough for Wayne to wriggle out if the door refused to cooperate. He forced himself off the couch and made the long, wearying journey across the rear compartment, crossing the vast distance of about a yard. Wayne grabbed the back of the front seat and heaved himself over and toppled down onto the floor in the back of the car. The rapid leaping motion made his head spinny and strange. He remained on all fours for several seconds, breathing deeply, trying to still the roiling disquiet in his stomach, trying as well to determine what had just happened to him. The gas that had gone up his snoot had disoriented him so that he hardly knew down from up. He had lost his bearings and collapsed into the back seat again. That was it. He rose to try once more. The world lurched unsteadily around him, but he waited, and at last it was still. He drew a deep breath, more gingerbread taste, and heaved himself over the divider and rolled and sat up on the floor of the back seat once again. His stomach upended itself, and for a moment his breakfast was back in his mouth. He swallowed it down. It had tasted better the first time. Down the hill, Manx was speaking, addressing the lake, his voice calm and unhurried. Wayne considered the rear compartment, trying to establish to himself how he had managed to wind up here again. It was as if the back seat went on forever. It was like there was nothing but back seat. He felt as dizzy as if he had just climbed off the Gravitron at the county fair, that ride that spun you faster and faster until centrifugal force stuck you to the wall. Get up! Don't quit! He saw these words in his mind as clearly as black letters painted on the boards of a white fence. This time Wayne ducked his head and got a running start, and jumped over the divider and out of the rear compartment and back into the rear compartment, where he crashed to the carpeted floor. His iPhone leaped out of the pocket of his shorts. He got up on all fours, but had to grab the shag carpet to keep from falling over. Was that dizzy and lightheaded? He felt as if the car were moving, spinning across black ice, revolving in a great swooping, nauseating circle. The sense of sideways motion was almost overpowering, and he had to briefly shut his eyes to block it out. When he dared to lift his head and look around, the first thing he saw was his phone, resting on the carpet just a few feet away. He reached for it, in the slow-motion way of an astronaut reaching for a floating candy bar. He called his father, the only number he had stored under favorites, One Touch. He felt that One Touch was almost all he could manage. "What up, dog?" Lewis Carmody said, his voice so warm and friendly and unworried, Wayne felt a sob rise into his own throat at the sound of it. Until that moment he had not realized how close he was to tears. His throat constricted dangerously. He was not sure he would be able to breathe, let alone speak. He shut his eyes and had a brief, nearly crippling tactile memory of his cheek pressing to his father's bristly face, his father's rough 3-day growth of spiky brown bear fur. "Dad," he said. "Dad, I'm in the back of a car. I can't get out." He tried to explain, but it was hard. It was hard to get all the air he needed to speak, hard to speak through his tears. His eyes burned, his vision blurred. It was hard to explain about the gas mask man and Charlie Manx and Hooper and gingerbread smoke and how the back seat went on forever. He wasn't sure what he said. Something about Manx, something about the car. Then the gas mask man was shooting again. The gun went off over and over as he fired at the float. His pistol jumped in his hand, flashing in the dark. When it had gotten so dark.
"They're shooting, Dad,"
Wayne said in a hoarse, strained tone of voice he hardly recognized.
"They're shooting at Mom."
Wayne peered out through the windshield into the gloom, but couldn't tell if any of the bullets had hit his mother or not. He couldn't see her. She was part of the lake, the darkness. How she took to darkness. How easily she slipped away from him. Manx did not stay to watch the gas mask man shoot the water. He was already halfway up the hill. He clutched the side of his head like a man listening to an earpiece, receiving a message from his superiors, although it was impossible to conceive of anyone who might be superior to Manx. The gas mask man emptied his gun and turned away from the water himself. He swayed as he began to mount the hill, walking like one supporting a great burden on his shoulders. They would reach the car soon. Wayne did not know what would happen then, but still had his wits about him well enough to know that if they saw his phone, they would take it away.
"I have to go," Wayne told his father. "They're coming back. I'll call when I can. Don't call me. They might hear it. They might hear even if I turn it to mute."
His father was shouting his name, but there wasn't time to say more. Wayne hit end call and flicked the phone over to mute. He looked for a place to stick the phone, thinking he would shove it down between the seats. But then he saw there were walnut drawers with polished silver knobs set beneath the front seats. He slid one open, flipped the phone in, and kicked it shut as Manx opened the driver's side door. Manx slung the silver hammer onto the front seat and climbed halfway in. He held a silk handkerchief to the side of his face, but he lowered it when he saw Wayne kneeling on the carpeted floor. Wayne made a small, shrill sound of horror at the sight of Manx's face. Two distinct strings of ear dangled from the side of his head. His long, gaunt face wore a dull red wash of blood. A flap of skin hung from his forehead, some of his eyebrow sticking to it. Bone glistened beneath.
"I suppose I look quite a fright,"
Manx said, and grinned to show pink-stained teeth. He pointed to the side of his head.
"Here today, gone tomorrow."
Wayne felt faint. The back of the car seemed unaccountably dark, as if Manx had brought the night in with him when he opened the door. The tall man dropped behind the wheel. The door slammed itself shut, and then the window cranked itself up. It wasn't Manx. Couldn't be Manx doing it. He was clutching one hand to his ear again, and the other was gently pressed to that loose flap of skin across his brow. The gas mask man had reached the passenger side door and pulled on the handle. But as he did, the lock slammed down. The gear shift wiggled and clunked into reverse. The car lunged a few feet backward, rocks spitting from under the tires.
"No!"
the gas mask man screamed. He was holding the latch when the car moved and was almost dragged off balance. He stumbled after the car, trying to keep one hand on the hood as if he could hold the Rolls-Royce in place.
"No, Mr. Manx, don't go. I'm sorry. I didn't mean it. It was a mistake."
His voice was ragged with horror and grief. He ran to the passenger door and grabbed the latch and pulled again. Manx leaned toward him. Through the window, he said,
"You are on my naughty list now, Bing Partridge. You have big ideas if you think I ought to take you to Christmas land after the mess you have made. I am afraid to let you in. How do I know, if I allow you to ride with us, that you will not riddle the car with bullets?"
"I swear, I'll be nice. I'll be nice, I will. I'll be nice as sugar and spice. Don't leave. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry."
The inside of his gas mask was steamed over, and he spoke between sobs.
"I wish I'd shot myself. I do. I wish it was my ear. Oh, Bing, Bing, you stupid thing."
"That is plenty of your ridiculous noise. My head hurts enough as it is."
The lock banged back up. The gas mask man yanked the door open and fell into the car.
I didn't mean it. I swear I didn't mean it. I will do anything. Anything.
His eyes widened in a flash of inspiration. I could cut my ear off. My own ear. I don't care. I don't need it. I have to. Do you want me to cut off my own ear?
I want you to shut up. If you feel like cutting something off, you could start with your tongue. Then at least we would have some peace.
The car accelerated in reverse, thudding down onto blacktop, undercarriage crunching. As it hit the road, it slopped around to the right to face back in the direction of the highway. The gear shift wiggled again and jumped into drive. In all this time, Manx did not touch the steering wheel or the stick, but remained clutching his ear and turned in his seat to look at the gas mask man.
The gingerbread smoke, Wayne thought with a kind of dull-edged wonder. It was making him see things. Cars didn't drive themselves. Back seats didn't go on forever.
The gas mask man rocked back and forth, making piteous noises and shaking his head.
Stupid, the gas mask man whispered. I am so stupid.
He banged his head on the dash forcefully, twice.
You will quit right this instant, or I am leaving you by the side of the road. There is no reason for you to take out your failures on the handsome interior of my car, Manx said.
The car jolted forward and began to rush away from the cottage. Manx's hands never left his face. The steering wheel moved minutely from side to side, guiding the rolls along the road. Wayne narrowed his eyes, fixed his stare upon it. He pinched his cheek very hard, twisting the flesh, but the pain did nothing to clear his vision. The car went on driving itself, so either the gingerbread smoke was causing him to hallucinate, or... But there wasn't an or in this line of reasoning. He didn't want to start thinking or. He turned his head and looked out the rear window. He had a last glimpse of the lake under its low blanket of fog. The water was as smooth as a plate of new-minted steel, as smooth as the blade of a knife. If his mother was there, he saw no sign of her.
Bing! Have a look in the glove compartment, and I believe you will find a pair of scissors and some tape.
Do you want me to cut out my own tongue? The gas mask man asked hopefully.
No, I want you to bandage my head, unless you would rather sit there and watch me bleed to death. I suppose that would be an entertaining spectacle.
No!
The gas mask man screamed.
Well then, you will have to do what you can for my ear and my head, and take off that mask. It is impossible to talk to you while you have that thing on.
The gas mask man's head made a popping sound as it came out of the mask, much like a cork popping from a bottle of wine. The face beneath was flushed and reddened, and there were tears streaked all down his flabby, quivering cheeks. He rummaged through the glove compartment and came up with a roll of surgical tape and a pair of little silver scissors. He unzipped his tracksuit to reveal a stained white muscle shirt and shoulders so furry they brought to mind silverback gorillas. He stripped off the undershirt and zipped the jacket up. The blinker clicked on. The car slowed for a stop sign, then turned onto the highway. Bing scissored several long strips of undershirt. He folded one neatly and put it against Manx's ear.
Hold that there, Bing said and hiccuped in a miserable sort of way.
I would like to know what she cut me with, Manx said.
He glanced into the back seat again, met Wayne's gaze.
I have had a history of poor dealings with your mother, you know. It is like fighting with a bag of cats.
Bing said,
I wish maggots were eating her. I wish maggots were eating her eyes.
That is a vile image.
Bing looped another long strip of undershirt around Manx's head, binding the pad to his ear and covering the slash across his forehead. He began to fix the undershirt in place with crosswise strips of surgical tape. Manx was still looking at Wayne.
You are a quiet one. Do you have anything to say for yourself?
Let me go, Wayne said.
I will, Manx said.
They blew past the Green Bough Diner, where Wayne and his mother had eaten breakfast sandwiches that morning. Thinking back on the morning was like thinking back on a half-remembered dream. Had he seen Charlie Manx's shadow when he first woke up? It seemed he had.
"I knew you were coming," Wayne said.
He was surprised to hear himself say such a thing.
"I knew all day."
"It is hard to keep a child from thinking about presents on the night before Christmas," Manx said.
He winced as Bing pressed another strip of tape in place. The steering wheel rocked gently from side to side, and the car hugged the curves.
"Is this car driving itself?" Wayne asked. "Or am I just seeing that because he sprayed stuff in my face?"
"You don't need to talk," the gas mask man screamed at him. "Quaker meeting has begun. No more laughing, no more fun, or we cut out your stupid tongue."
"Will you stop talking about cutting out tongues?" Max said. "I am beginning to think you have a fixation. I am speaking to the boy. I do not need you to referee."
Abashed, the gas mask man returned to snipping strips of tape.
"You are not seeing things, and it is not driving itself," Max said. "I am driving it. I am the car, and the car is me. It is an authentic Rolls-Royce Wraith, assembled in Bristol in 1937, shipped to America in 1938, one of fewer than 500 on these shores. But it is also an extension of my thoughts, and can take me to roads that can exist only in the imagination."
"There," Bing said, "all fixed."
Manx laughed.
"For me to be all fixed, we would have to go back and search that woman's lawn for the rest of my year."
Bing's face shriveled, his eyes narrowed to squints, his shoulders hitched and jerked with silent sobs.
"But he did spray something in my face," Wayne said. "Something that smelled like gingerbread."
"Just something to put your mind at ease. If Bing had used his spray properly, you would be resting peaceably already."
Manx cast a cool, disgusted look at his traveling companion. Wayne considered this. Thinking a thing through was like moving a heavy crate across a room, a lot of straining effort.
"How come it isn't making you two rest peaceably?" Wayne asked finally.
Manx
said. He was looking down at his white silk shirt, now stained crimson with blood.
"Oh, you are in your own pocket universe back there. I don't let anything come up front."
He sighed heavily.
"There is no saving this shirt. I feel we should all have a moment of silence for it. This shirt is a silk Riddle McIntyre, the finest shirt maker in the West for 100 years. Gerald Ford wore nothing but Riddle McIntyres. I might as well use it to clean engine parts now. Blood will never come out of silk."
"Blood will never come out of silk," Wayne whispered.
This statement had an epigrammatic quality to it. Felt like an important fact. Manx considered him calmly from the front seat. Wayne stared back through pulses of bright and dark as if clouds were fleeting across the sun. But there was no sun today, and that throbbing brightness was in his head, behind his eyes. He was out on the extreme edge of shock, a place where time was different, moving in spurts, catching in place, then jumping forward again. Wayne heard a sound, a long way off, an angry, urgent wail. For a moment he thought it was someone screaming, and he remembered Manx hitting his mother with his silver mallet, and he thought he might be sick. But as the sound approached them and intensified, he identified it as a police siren.
"She is right up and at them," Manx said. "I have to give your mother credit. She does not delay when it comes to making trouble for me."
"What will you do when the police see us?" Wayne asked.
"I do not think they will bother us. They are going to your mother's."
Cars ahead of them began to pull to either side of the road. A blue-silver strobe appeared at the top of a low hill ahead of them, dropped over the slope, and rushed toward them. The Wraith eased itself to the margin of the road and slowed down considerably, but didn't stop. The police cruiser punched past them, doing nearly 60. Wayne turned his head to watch it go. The driver did not even glance at them. Manx drove on, or really, the car drove on. Manx still hadn't touched the wheel. He had folded down the sun visor and was inspecting himself in the mirror. The bright dark flashes were coming more slowly now, like a roulette wheel winding down, the ball soon to settle on red or black. Wayne still felt no real terror, had left that behind in the yard with his mother. He picked himself up off the floor and settled on the couch.
"You should see a doctor," Wayne said. "If you drop me off somewhere in the woods, you could go to a doctor and get your ear and head fixed before I walked back to town or anyone found me."
"Thank you for your concern, but I would prefer not to receive medical treatment in handcuffs," Mank said. "The road will make me better. The road always does."
"Where are we going?"
Wayne asked. His voice seemed to come from a distance.
"Christmas land."
"Christmas land," Wayne repeated. "What's that?"
"A special place. A special place for special children."
"Really?"
Wayne pondered this for a time, then said,
"I don't believe you. That's just something to tell me so I won't be scared."
He paused again, then decided to brave one more question.
"Are you going to kill me?"
"I am surprised you even need to ask. It would have been easy to kill you back at your mother's house." "No. And Christmas land is real enough. It is not so easy to find. You cannot get to it by any road in this world, but there are other roads than the ones you will find on a map. It is outside of our world, and at the same time it is only a few miles from Denver. And then again, it is right here in my head."
He tapped his right temple with one finger.
"And I take it with me everywhere I go. There are other children there, and not one of them is held against his or her will. They would not leave for anything. They are eager to meet you, Wayne Carmody. They are eager to be your friend. You will see them soon enough, and when you finally do, it will feel like coming home."
The blacktop thumped and hummed under the tires.
"The last hour has seen a lot of excitement," Mank said. "Put your head down, child. If anything interesting happens, I will be sure to wake you."
There was no reason to do a thing, Charlie Manx told him. But before long, Wayne found he was on his side, his head resting on the plump leather seat. If there was any more peaceful sound in all the world than the road murmuring under tires, Wayne didn't know what it was. The roulette wheel clicked and clicked and stopped at last. The ball settled into black. The lake. Vic breaststroked into the shallows, then crawled the last few feet up onto the beach. There she rolled onto her back, legs still in the lake. She shook furiously, in fierce, almost crippling spasms, and made sounds too angry to be sobs. She might have been crying. She wasn't sure. Her insides hurt badly, as if she had spent a day and a night vomiting. In a kidnapping, nothing is more important than what happens in the first 30 minutes, Vic thought, her mind replaying something she had once heard on TV. Vic did not think what she did in the next 30 minutes mattered at all, did not think any cop anywhere had the power to find Charlie Manx and the Wraith. Still, she shoved herself to her feet because she needed to do what she could, whether it made a difference or not. She walked like a drunk in a hard crosswind, swaying, following a wandering path to the back door, which is where she fell again. She went up the steps on hands and knees, used the railing to get to her feet. The phone began to ring. Vic forced herself onward, through another burst of lancing pain, sharp enough to drive the breath out of her. She reeled through the kitchen, reached the phone, caught it on the third ring, just before it could go to voicemail.
"I need help," Vic said. "Who is this? You have to help me. Someone took my son."
"Aw, it's okay, Miss McQueen," said the little girl on the other end of the line. "Daddy will drive safe and make sure Wayne has a real good time. He'll be here with us soon. He'll be here in Christmas land, and we'll show him all our games. Isn't that fine?"
Vic hit end call, then dialed 911. A woman told her she had reached emergency services. Her voice was calm and detached. "What's your name and the nature of your emergency?"
"Victoria McQueen. I've been attacked. A man has kidnapped my son. I can describe the car. They only just drove away. Please send someone."
The dispatcher tried to keep the same tone of steady calm but couldn't quite manage it. Adrenaline changed everything. "How badly are you hurt?"
"Forget that. Let's talk about the kidnapper. His name is Charles Talent Manx. He's, I don't know, old. Dead, Vic thought, but didn't say. In his 70s, he's over 6 feet tall, balding, about 200 pounds. There's another man with him, someone younger. I didn't see him too well.
Because he was wearing a fucking gas mask for some reason. But she didn't say that either.
They're in a Rolls-Royce Wraith, a classic, 1930s. My son is in the back seat. My son is 12. His name is Bruce, but he doesn't like that name. And Vic began to cry, couldn't help it. He has black hair and is 5 feet tall and was wearing a white T-shirt with nothing on it.
Victoria, the police are en route. Was either of these men armed?
Yes, the younger one has a gun, and Manx has some kind of hammer. He hit me with it a couple times.
I'm dispatching an ambulance to see to your injuries. Did you happen to get the license plate?
It's a fucking Rolls Royce from the 30s with my little boy in the back. How many of those do you think are driving around? Her voice snagged on a sob. She coughed it up and coughed up the license plate tag as well. N-O-S-4-A-2. It's a vanity plate. Spells a German word. Nosferatu.
What's it mean?
What's it matter? Look it the fuck up!
I'm sorry. I understand you're upset. We're sending out an alert now. We're going to do everything we can to get your son back. I know you're scared. Be calm. Please try to be calm. Vic had a sense that the dispatcher was half talking to herself. There was a wavering tone in her voice, like the woman was struggling not to cry. Help is on the way.
Victoria. Just Vic. Thank you. I'm sorry I swore at you.
It's all right. Don't worry about it. Vic, if they're in a distinctive car like a Rolls Royce, that's good. That will stand out. They aren't going to get far in a vehicle like that. If they're anywhere on the road, someone will see them. But no one did. When the EMTs tried to escort her to the ambulance, Vic elbowed free from them, told them to keep their fucking hands off. A police officer, a small, portly Indian woman, inserted herself between Vic and the men. "You can examine her here," she said, leading Vic back to the couch. Her voice carried the lightest of accents, a lilt that made every statement sound both vaguely musical and like a question. It is better if she doesn't go. What if the kidnapper calls? Vic huddled on the couch in her wet cutoffs, wrapped in a throw. An EMT wearing blue gloves planted himself next to her and asked her to drop the blanket and remove her shirt. That got the attention of the cops in the room, who cast surreptitious glances Vic's way, but Vic complied wordlessly, without a second thought. She slopped her wet shirt on the floor. She wasn't wearing a bra, and she covered her breasts with one arm, hunching forward to let the EMT look at her back. The EMT inhaled sharply. The Indian police officer, her name tag read Chitra, stood on Vic's other side, looking down the curve of Vic's back. She made a sound herself, a soft cry of sympathy.
"I thought you said he tried to run you over," Chitra said. "You did not say he succeeded."
"She's going to have to sign a form," said the EMT. "A thing that says she refused to get in the ambulance. I need to cover my ass here. She could have cracked ribs or a pop spleen, and I could miss it. I want it on record that I don't believe treating her here is in her best medical interest."
"Maybe it's not in my best medical interest," Vic said, "but it is in yours."
Vic heard a sound go around the room. Not quite laughter, but close to it, a low male ripple of mirth. There were by now 6 or 7 of them in the room, standing around pretending not to look at her chest, the tattoo of a V6 engine set above her breasts. A cop sat on the other side of her, the first cop she had seen who wasn't in uniform. He wore a blue blazer that was too short at the wrists, a red tie with a coffee stain on it, and a face that would have won an ugly contest walking away, bushy white eyebrows turning yellow at the tips, nicotine-stained teeth, a comically gourd-like nose, a jutting cleft chin. He dug in one pocket, then another, then lifted his wide, flat rear and found a reporter's notebook in his back pocket. He opened it, then stared at the pad with a look of utter bafflement, as if he had been asked to write a 500-word essay on Impressionist painting. It was that blank look, more than anything else, that let Vic know he wasn't the guy. He was a placeholder. The person who would matter, the one who would be handling the search for her son, who would coordinate resources and compile information, wasn't here yet. She answered his questions anyway. He started in the right place, with Wayne. Age, height, weight, what he'd been wearing, if she had a recent photo. At some point, Chitra walked away, then returned with an oversized hoodie that said, New Hampshire State Police on the front. Vic tugged it on. It came to her knees. The father? Asked the ugly man, whose name was Daltrey. Lives in Colorado. Divorced? Never married. How's he feel about you having custody of the kid? I don't have custody. Wayne is just... We're on good terms about our son. It's not an issue. Got a number where we can reach him? Yes, but he's on a plane right now. He visited for the 4th. He's headed back this evening. You sure about that? How do you know he boarded the plane? I'm sure he had nothing to do with this, if that's what you're asking. We're not fighting over our son. My ex is the most harmless and easygoing man you've ever met. Oh, I don't know. I've met some pretty easygoing fellas. I know a guy up in Maine who leads a Buddhist-themed therapy group. Teaches people about managing their temper and addictions through transcendental meditation. The only time this guy ever lost his composure was the day his wife served him with a restraining order. First he lost his zen, then he lost 2 bullets in the back of her head. But that Buddhist-themed therapy group he runs sure is popular on his cell block in Shawshank. Lot of guys with anger management issues in there. Lou didn't have anything to do with this. I told you, I know who took my son. Okay, okay, I have to ask this stuff. Tell me about the guy who worked on your back. No, wait, tell me about his car first. She told him. Daltrey shook his head and made a sound that could have been a laugh if it expressed any humor. Mostly what it expressed was incredulity. Your man ain't too bright. If he's on the road, I give him less than half an hour. Before what? Before he's face down in the feckin' dirt with some state cop's boot on his neck. You don't grab a kid in an antique car and drive away. That's about as smart as driving an ice cream truck. Kinda stands out. People look. Everyone is going to notice a period Rolls Royce. It isn't going to stand out. What do you mean? He asked. She didn't know what she meant, so she didn't say anything. Daltrey said, And you recognized one of your assailants. This would be Charles Manx. Looking at something he had scribbled in his notepad. How would you know him? He kidnapped me when I was 17 years old, and held me for 2 days. That quieted the room. Look it up, she said. It's in his file. Charles Talent Manx, and he's pretty good at not getting caught. I have to change out of these wet shorts and into some sweats. I'd like to do that in my bedroom, if you don't mind. I feel like Mom has flashed enough skin for one day. Vic held in her mind her one last glimpse of Wayne, trapped in the back seat of the Rolls. She saw him swatting a hand at the air. Go on, get away! Almost as if he were angry with her. He had already looked as pale as any corpse. She saw Wayne in flashes, and it was like the hammer thudding into her again, walloping her in the chest instead of the back. Here he was, sitting naked in a sandbox, behind their townhouse in Denver, a chubby 3-year-old with a thatch of black hair, using a plastic shovel to bury a plastic telephone. Here he was on Christmas Day in rehab, sitting on the cracked and crinkly plastic surface of a couch, plucking at a wrapped gift, then tearing the wrapping away to show the white boxed iPhone. Here he was walking out onto the dock with a toolbox that was too heavy for him. Bang! Each vision of him hit her, and her bruised insides clenched up again. Bang! He was a baby, sleeping naked on her naked breast. Bang! He was kneeling in the gravel next to her, arms greasy to the elbows, helping her to thread the motorcycle chain back onto its sprockets. Sometimes the pain was so intense, so pure, the room darkened at the edges of her vision, and she felt faint. At some point she had to move, couldn't stay on the couch anymore. If anyone is hungry, I can make something to eat, she said. It was almost 9:30 in the evening by then. I've got a full fridge. We'll send out for something, Daltrey said. Don't trouble yourself. They had the TV on, turned to NECN, New England Cable News. They had gone up with the alert about Wayne an hour before. Vic had seen it twice and knew she couldn't watch it again. First they would show the photo she had given them of Wayne in an Aerosmith t-shirt and an Avalanche wool cap, squinting into bright spring sunlight. She already regretted it, didn't like how the cap hid his black hair and made his ears stick out. This would be followed by a photograph of Vic herself, the one from the search engine website. She assumed they were showing that one to get a pretty girl on the screen. She was wearing makeup and a black skirt and cowboy boots and had her head tipped back to laugh, a jarring image considering the situation. They didn't show Max. They didn't even say his name. They described the kidnappers only as two white males in an antique black Rolls Royce.
Why don't they tell people who they're looking for?
Vic asked the first time she saw the report. Daltrey shrugged, said he would find out, got off the couch and wandered into the yard to talk to some other men. When he came back in, though, he didn't offer any new information. And when the report ran the second time, they were still looking for two white males, out of the approximately 14 million white males to be found in New England. If she saw the report a third time and there wasn't a picture of Charlie Manx, if they didn't say his name, she thought she might put a chair through the TV. Please, Vic said now. I've got some slaw and cold ham, a whole loaf of bread. I could lay out sandwiches. Daltrey shifted in his seat and looked uncertainly at some of the other policemen in the room, torn between hunger and decency. Officer Chitra said, I think you should, of course. I'll come with you. It was a relief to get out of the living room, which was too crowded with bodies, cops coming and going, walkie-talkies squawking continuously. She stopped to take in the view of the lawn through the open front door. In the glare of the spotlights, it was brighter in the yard at night than it had been in the midday fog. She saw the toppled fence rails and a man in rubber gloves measuring the tire treads imprinted in the soft loam. The cop cars were flashing their strobes as if at the scene of an emergency, and never mind that the emergency had driven away hours before. Wayne strobed in her mind, just like that, and for a moment she felt dangerously light-headed. Chitra saw her sag and took her elbow, helped her the rest of the way into the kitchen. It was better in there. They had the room to themselves. The kitchen windows looked out on the dock and the lake. The dock was lit up by more of those big tripod-mounted spotlights. A cop with a flashlight had waded into the water up to his thighs, but she couldn't tell to what purpose. A plainclothesman watched from the end of the dock, pointing and giving directions. A boat floated 40 feet offshore. A boy stood in the front end, next to a dog, staring at the cops, the lights, the house. When Vic saw the dog, she remembered Hooper. She had not thought of him once since seeing the headlights of the Wraith in the mist.
Someone needs to go look for the dog, Vic said. He must be outside somewhere.
She had to stop every few words to catch her breath. Chitra looked at her with great sensitivity. Do not worry about the dog now, Miss McQueen. Have you had any water? It is important to hydrate yourself.
I'm surprised he isn't barking his head off, Vic said, with all this commotion.
Chitra ran a hand down Vic's arm, once and again, then squeezed Vic's elbow. Vic looked at the policewoman in sudden understanding.
You had so much else to worry about, Chitra began.
Oh, God, Vic said, and began to cry again, her whole body shaking.
No one wanted to upset you even more.
She rocked, holding herself, crying in a way she hadn't since those first days after her father left her and her mother. Vic had to lean on the counter for a while, wasn't sure her legs had the strength to continue to support her. Chitra reached over and tentatively rubbed her back.
Shh, said Vic's mother, dead for 2 months. Just breathe, Vicky. Just breathe for me.
She said it in a light Indian accent, but Vic recognized her mother's voice all the same, recognized the feel of her mother's hand on her back. Everyone you lost was still there with you. And so maybe no one was ever lost at all.
Unless they went with Charlie Manx.
In a while, Vic sat down and drank a glass of water. She drained the whole thing in 5 swallows without stopping for air, was desperate for it. It was lukewarm and sweet and good and tasted of the lake. Chitra opened cupboards looking for paper plates. Vic got up and over the other woman's objections began to help with sandwiches. She made a row of paper plates and put 2 pieces of white bread on each, tears dripping off her nose and falling on the bread. She hoped Wayne didn't know that Hooper was dead. She thought sometimes that Wayne was closer to Hooper than he was to either her or Lou. Vic found the ham, coleslaw, and a bag of Doritos and began to make up the plates.
There's a secret to cop sandwiches, said a woman who had come in behind her. Vic took one look and knew this was the guy she had been waiting for, even if the guy wasn't a guy.
This woman had frizzy brown hair and a little snub nose. She was plain at first glance, devastatingly pretty on the second.
She wore a tweed coat with corduroy patches on the elbows and blue jeans and could have passed for a grad student at a liberal arts college if not for the 9mm strapped under her left arm. "What's the secret?" Vic asked.
"Show you," she said,
and eased herself in, took the spoon, and dumped coleslaw into one of the sandwiches on top of the ham. She built a roof of Doritos over the coleslaw, squirted Dijon mustard on the chips, buttered a slice of bread, and squished it all together.
"The butter is the important part."
"Works like glue, right?"
"Yes, and cops are, by nature, cholesterol magnets."
"I thought the FBI only came in on kidnappings in cases where the kid has been hauled across state lines," Vic said. The frizzy-haired woman frowned, then glanced down at the laminated card clipped to the breast of her jacket, the one that said over an unsmiling photograph of her face. FBI, psych eval, Tabitha K. Hutter.
"Technically, we're not in it yet," Hutter said. "But you're 40 minutes from 3 state borders and less than 2 hours from Canada. Your assailants have had your son for almost..."
"My assailants?" Vic said. She felt a flush of heat in her cheeks. "Why do people keep talking about my assailants? Like we don't know anything about them. It's starting to piss me off. Charlie Manx is the man. Charlie Manx and someone else are driving around with my kid."
"Charlie Manx is dead, Miss McQueen. He's been dead since May."
"Got a body?"
That gave Hutter pause. She pursed her lips, said, "He has a death certificate. There were photos of him in the morgue. He was autopsied. His chest was split open. The coroner took his heart out and weighed it. Those are convincing reasons to believe he didn't attack you."
"And I've got half a dozen reasons to believe he did," Vic said. "They're all up and down my back. You want me to take my shirt off and show you the bruises? Every other cop in this joint has had a good look."
Hutter stared at her without reply. Her gaze held the simple curiosity of a small child. It rattled Vic to be observed so intently. So few adults gave themselves permission to stare that way.
At last, Hutter shifted her eyes, turned her gaze toward the kitchen table.
"Will you sit with me?"
Without waiting for an answer, she picked up a leather satchel she'd brought with her and settled at the kitchen table. She peered up expectantly, waiting for Vic to sit with her. Vic looked to Chitra as if for advice, remembering how the woman had, for a moment, comforted her and whispered to her like her mother. But the policewoman was finishing the sandwiches and bustling them out. Vic sat. Hutter removed an iPad from her briefcase, and the screen glowed. More than ever, she looked like a grad student, one preparing a dissertation on the Bronte sisters, perhaps. She passed her finger over the glass, swiping through some sort of digital file, then looked up.
"At his last medical exam, Charlie Manx was listed at approximately 85 years old."
"You think he's too old to have done what he did?" Vic asked.
"I think he's too dead. But tell me what happened, and I'll try to get my head around it."
Vic did not complain that she had already told the story 3 times, start to finish. The other times didn't count, because this was the first cop who mattered, if any cop mattered. Vic was not sure one did. Charlie Manx had been claiming lives for a long time and had never been caught, passed through the nets that law enforcement threw at him like silver smoke. How many children had climbed into his car and never been seen again?
"Hundreds," came the answer, a whisper of a thought.
Vic told her story, the parts of it she felt she could tell. She left out Maggie Lee. She did not mention she had ridden her motorcycle onto an impossible covered bridge of the imagination shortly before Manx tried to run her down. She did not discuss the psychotropic medication she did not take anymore. When Vic got to the part about Manx hitting her with the hammer, Hutter frowned. She asked Vic to describe the hammer in detail, tapping the keyboard on her iPad screen. She stopped Vic again when Vic told her about how she had gotten up off the ground and gone after Manx with the tappet key.
"Tapper what?"
"Tappet key," Vic said. "Triumph made them special just for their bikes. It's a spanner, kind of wrench. I was working on the motorcycle and had it in my pocket."
"Where is it now?"
"I don't know. I had it in my hand when I had to run. I was probably still holding it when I went in the lake."
"This is when the other man started shooting at you. Tell me about that," she told.
"He shot Manx in the face?" Hutter said. "It wasn't like that. He clipped him in the ear."
"Vic, I want you to help me think this through. This man, Charlie Manx, we agree he was probably 85 years old at the time of his last medical exam.
He spent 10 years in a coma. Most coma patients require months of rehabilitation before they can walk again. You are telling me you cut him with this tapper key. Tap it! And then he was shot, but still had the strength to drive away. What Vic could not say was that Manx wasn't like other men. She had felt it when he swung the hammer, a coiled strength that belied his advanced age and gaunt frame. Hutter insisted that Manx had been opened up, that his heart had been removed during the autopsy, and Vic didn't doubt it. For a man who'd had his heart taken out and put back in, a nick in the ear wasn't that big a deal. Instead, she said, "Maybe the other guy drove. You want me to explain it? I can't. I can only tell you what happened. What is your point? Manx has got my 12-year-old in his car, and he's going to kill him to get even with me. But for some reason, we're discussing the limits of your FBI imagination. Why is that?" She looked in Hutter's face, into Hutter's bland, calm eyes, and understood.
"Jesus, you don't believe a fucking word, do you?"
Hutter deliberated for a time, and when she spoke, Vic had a sense that she was choosing words carefully. "I believe that your boy is missing, and I believe you've been hurt. I believe that you're in hell right now. Other than that, I'm keeping my mind open. I hope you'll see that as an asset and work with me. We both want the same thing. We want your boy back safe. If I thought it would help, I'd be out there driving around looking for him. But that's not how I find the bad guys. I find them by collecting information and sorting out what's useful from what isn't. Really, it's not so different from your books, the search engine stories. You know them? How young are you?" Hutter smiled slightly. "Not that young. It's in your file. Also, an instructor at Quantico uses pictures from search engine in his lectures to show us how hard it is to pick out relevant details in a clutter of visual information." "What else is in my file?" Hutter's smile faltered slightly. Her gaze did not. "That you were found guilty of arson in Colorado in 2009. That you spent a month in a Colorado mental hospital, where you were diagnosed with severe PTSD and schizophrenia. You take antipsychotics and have a history of alcohol."
"Jesus, you think I hallucinated getting the shit kicked out of me?" Vic said, her stomach clenching. "You think I hallucinated getting shot at?"
"We have yet to confirm a shooting took place." Vic pushed back her chair.
"He fired at me. He fired 6 bullets. Emptied his gun."
Thinking now, her back had been to the lake. It was possible every single bullet, even the one that had gone through Manx's ear, had wound up in the water. "We're still looking for slugs."
"My bruises," Vic said.
"I don't doubt someone fought you," said the FBI agent. "I don't think anyone doubts that." There was something about this statement, some dangerous implication, that Vic couldn't figure out. Who would have fought her if not Manx? But Vic was too exhausted, too emotionally spent to try to make sense out of it. She didn't have it in her to work out whatever Hutter was stepping around. Vic looked at Hutter's laminated badge again. Psych eval.
"Wait a minute. Wait a fucking... You're not a detective. You're a doctor."
"Why don't we look at some pictures?" Hutter said.
"No," Vic said. "That's a complete waste of time. I don't need to look at mugshots. I told you, one of them was wearing a gas mask. The other was Charlie Manx. I know what Charlie Manx looks like. Jesus, why the fuck am I talking to a doctor? I want to talk to a detective."
"I wasn't going to ask you to look at pictures of criminals," Hutter said. "I was going to ask you to look at pictures of hammers." It was such a baffling, unexpected thing to hear that Vic just sat there, mouth open, unable to make a sound. Before anything came to her, there was a commotion in the other room. Chitra's voice rose, wavering and querulous, and Daltrey said something, and then there was a third voice, Midwestern and emotional. Vic recognized the third voice at once, but couldn't work out what it was doing in her house when it ought to be on a plane, if not in Denver by now. Her confusion delayed her reaction time, so that she was not all the way out of her chair when Lou came into the room, trailing an entourage of cops. He hardly looked like himself. His face was ashy, and his eyes stood out in his big, round face. He looked like he had lost 10 pounds since Vic had last seen him, 2 days earlier. She rose and reached for him, and in the same moment he enfolded her in his arms.
"What are we gonna do?" Lou asked her.
What the hell are we gonna do now, Vic? The kitchen. When they sat back down at the table, Vic took Lou's hand, the most natural thing in the world. She was surprised to feel the heat in his chubby fingers, and she looked again at his washed-out, sweat-slick face. She recognized that he looked seriously ill, but took it for fear. There were five of them in the kitchen now. Lou and Vic and Hutter sat at the table. Daltrey leaned against the kitchen counter, squeezing his alcoholic's nose in a hanky. Officer Chitra stood in the doorway, had hustled the other cops out at Hutter's command. "You're Louis Carmody," Hutter said. She spoke like the director of the school play, letting Lou know who he would be playing in the spring performance. "You're the father."
"Guilty," Lou said.
"Say again," Hutter asked.
"Guilty as charged," Lou said. "I'm the dad. Who are you? Are you like a social worker?"
"I'm an FBI agent. My name is Tabitha Hutter. A lot of the guys in the office call me Tabby the Hutt." She smiled slightly.
"That's funny. A lot of the guys in the place I work call me Jabba the Hutt. Only they do it because I'm a fat shit."
"I thought you were in Denver," Hutter said.
"Missed my flight."
"No shit," said Daltrey. "Something come up?" Hutter said, "Detective Daltrey, I'll conduct the Q&A, thank you." Daltrey reached into the pocket of his coat. "Does anyone mind if I smoke?"
"Yes," Hutter said.
Daltrey held the pack for a moment, staring at her, then put it back in his pocket. There was a bland, unfocused quality to his eyes that reminded Vic of the membrane that slid across a shark's eyes right before he chomped into a seal.
"Why did you miss your plane, Mr. Carmody?" Hutter asked.
"Because I heard from Wayne."
"You heard from him?"
"He called me from the car on his iPhone. He said they were trying to shoot Vic, Manx, and the other guy. We only talked for a minute. He had to hang up because Manx and the other fellow were walking back to the car. He was scared, really scared, but holding it together. He's a little man, you know. He's always been a little man."
Lou bunched his fists up on the table and lowered his head. He grimaced as if he felt a sharp twinge of pain somewhere in his abdomen and blinked, and tears dripped onto the table. It came over him all of a sudden, without warning.
"He has to be a grown-up, because Vic and me did such a shitty job of being grown-ups ourselves."
Vic put her hands over his. Hutter and Daltrey exchanged a look, hardly seemed to notice Lou dissolving into tears.
"Do you think your son turned the phone off after he talked to you?" Hutter asked. "I thought if he had a SIM card in it, it didn't matter if it was on or off," Daltrey said. "I thought you federal people had a workaround."
"You can use his phone to find him," Vic said, her pulse quickening.
Hutter ignored her, said to Daltrey,
"We can have that done. It would take a while. I'd have to call Boston. But if it's an iPhone and it's turned on, we can use the Find My iPhone function to locate him right now, right here."
She lifted her iPad slightly.
"Right," Lou said. "That's right. I set up Find My iPhone the day we bought it for him, because I didn't want him to lose the thing."
He came around the table to look over Hutter's shoulder at her screen. His complexion was not improved by the unnatural glow of the monitor. "What's his email address and password?" Hutter asked, turning her head to look up at Lou.
He reached out with one hand to type it himself, but before he could, the FBI agent took a hold of his wrist. She pressed two fingers into his skin, as if taking his pulse. Even from where she sat, Vic could see a spot where the skin gleamed and seemed to have a splash of dried paste on it.
Hutter shifted her gaze to Lou's face.
"You had an EKG this evening."
"I fainted. I got upset. It was like a panic attack, dude. Some crazy son of a bitch has my kid. This shit happens to fat guys."
Until now, Vic had been too focused on Wayne to give much thought to Lou. How gray he looked, how exhausted. But at this, Vic felt struck through with sudden, sick apprehension.
"Oh, Lou, what do you mean you fainted?"
"It was after Wayne hung up on me. I kind of went down for a minute. I was fine, but airport security made me sit on the floor and get an EKG, make sure I wasn't going to vapor lock on them."
"Did you tell them your kid had been kidnapped?" Daltrey asked. Hutter flashed him a warning look that Daltrey pretended not to see.
"I'm not sure what I said to them. I was sort of confused at first, like dizzy. I know I told him my kid needed me. I know I told him that. All I could think was I had to get to my car. At some point, they said they were going to put me in an ambulance, and I told him to go, have fun with themselves. So I got up and walked away. It's possible a guy grabbed my arm and I dragged him a few feet. I was in a hurry.
So you didn't talk to the police at the airport about what had happened to your son? Daltrey asked. Didn't you think you could get here faster if you had a police escort?
It didn't even cross my mind. I wanted to talk to Vic first, Lou said, and Vic saw Daltrey and Hutter trade another glance.
Why did you want to talk to Victoria first? Hutter asked.